Welcome, everyone, to today's conference call. At this time, your lines have been placed on listen-only for today's conference until the question-and-answer portion of our call, at which time you will be prompted to press star one on your touch-tone phone. Please ensure that your line is unmuted and please record your name when prompted so that I may introduce your name and affiliation to ask your question. Conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn conference over to our host, Mr. Paul Fulton. Sir, you may proceed.
Thank you, and thank you all for joining us today for this embargoed briefing to update you on CDC's COVID-19 response. We are joined by CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield. He will provide opening remarks and will discuss a new report in the MMWR before taking your questions. We're also joined by a few more folks today. We have Rhode Island Department of Health Epidemiologist Amanda Della Grotta on the line, as well as from CDC, we have Dr. Aaron Saber-Schatz, the lead of CDC's Community Interventions and Critical Populations Task Force, and we also have Ruth Link Gellis, who is epidemiologist and author of today's WR. They are also available for the question and answer session. Please limit your question to one today so we can get to as many folks as possible, and also please be limited to the information that is being presented. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Dr. Redfield.
Thank you, Paul, and thank all of you for joining us today. We're nearly 8 months into the global pandemic, and my colleagues and I, along with others in the federal government and across the world, continue to fight this new virus. Want you to know that we understand the effects that this is having on our lives. As businesses, schools, and communities continue to open, we're all adapting to a new normal. Wearing masks, washing hands more often, interacting in smaller groups, and maintaining physical distance from one another when in crowds, these are all key new behaviors that we've adopted to slow the spread of COVID-19. I'm sure you've heard the version of the phrase, maintain social distance, but it's important that we don't stay emotionally distant from each other. It's essential that we continue to practice what we know works, and we make sure that we connect to our families and friends so that we can get through this together. These behaviors that we know work, wearing masks, cohorting, quarantine, isolation, are highlighted in a new article focusing on child care centers in Rhode Island. As COVID-19 transmission slowed in Rhode Island, the state made a decision to reopen child care centers that had been out of operation for the previous 3 months. In order to reopen, the state required child care centers to adhere to certain measures, including reducing attendance capacity, limiting interactions between established student-teacher groups, ensuring that all adults wore masks, and screening adults and children daily for symptoms. During June and July, 52 confirmed and probable cases occurred across 29 child care programs. But only 4 of these programs had possible secondary spread of infection. Those cases occurred in the 29 child care programs. However, in 20 of these, there was only one case, and there was no apparent secondary transmissions. Additionally, the majority of COVID-19 cases occurred in mid to late July when infections were increasing across the state of Rhode Island. I wanted to highlight this report because it's likely that the limit spread of COVID-19 in this instance was due to the adherence of the child care program requirements and the efforts by the state health department to rapidly investigate and respond to these cases. This is, like other instances that we've highlighted, an example of and a testimony to the important role that everyone can play in slowing the spread of COVID-19 in their communities, wearing masks consistently and correctly, staying 6 feet away from each other, staying home when you're sick, and washing your hands frequently. Another way people can continue to keep themselves and their families safe as we head into the fall and the winter is to get the flu vaccine. Yesterday, my colleagues and I highlighted the longstanding and striking disparity in flu vaccine coverage, specifically in non-Hispanic Blacks, Hispanics, and American Indian and Alaska Native adults, relative to the non-Hispanic white adults that we continue to see year after year. These gaps in vaccination cover are particularly alarming this season as COVID-19 reveals another facet of health inequity in the United States. The same group with the lowest influenza vaccination coverage also are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. As part of CDC's enhanced response to the coming flu season and our efforts to maximize flu vaccination by increasing the availability of vaccine, CDC has purchased an additional 2 million doses of pediatric vaccine and 9.3 million doses of adult vaccine. These additional doses will ensure parents who may be newly unemployed understand that the Vaccine for Children Safety Net program that grants access for the uninsured and underinsured children and to guarantee adults at higher risk of COVID can get flu vaccine this September and October. CDC recommends getting vaccinated in September and October. I'm hopeful that the recommendations CDC, states, local, and even companies and organizations have for wearing masks and physically distancing will mean that there will be decreases in other respiratory viruses like influenza and viruses that we believe to be associated, for example, with AFM, those enteroviruses. I understand that masks can be uncomfortable to wear and sometimes difficult to remember to bring it with you when we go out. And I know it's hard to not see friends and celebrate with family some important moments in life. However, it is really important that these basics are powerful weapons, crucial steps for us to get back to what used to be. I want to thank everyone who's already been following the CDC guidance, as well as encourage others to understand how important their actions are to help others as much as they can to adhere to these important mitigation steps. Before taking questions, I also wanted to mention that today CDC is providing updates to the considerations for schools to align with new tools and resources and the latest COVID-19 information. The considerations are designed to help school administrators, one, to promote behaviors that will reduce the spread of COVID-19, two, to maintain healthy environments, three, to maintain healthy operations, and four, to prepare for when someone does get sick. Last month, we released new resources and tools to help parents, teachers, school administrators, and local officials protect students and staff as they move closer to beginning a new school year and do so safely and sensibly. Since that release, administrators and teachers have returned to work in school across the nation and begun to welcome back students in person and hybrid or virtual school activities. CDC staff have also remained hard at work in engaging federal, national, state, local partners, and communities to ensure that these guidance can reflect the most current science and evidence. The more communities embrace these actions needed to slow the spread of COVID, the faster schools will be able to reopen and stay open. We encourage everyone to review the considerations and tailor the strategies to their school-specific needs and their community context. During the last briefing, I mentioned that we owe it to our nation's children to take personal responsibility to do everything we can to lower the level of COVID-19 so that we can all get back to school safely. This is as true today as it was then. Schools provide a safe environment for our kids and grandkids to learn and grow academically, socially, emotionally. But schools are not islands in and of themselves. They are connected to the communities that surround them. So thank you very much, and I look forward to taking on your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Redfield. Just as a reminder, please do limit your questions to one today so that we can get to as many folks as we can, and please try to limit it to the information that's being presented today. I also just wanted to remind you that in addition to Dr. Redfield, we have several subject matter available experts to answer your questions, including our colleagues in Rhode Island. Okay, I think with that, we're good to open up for questions.
Thank you. Our first question comes from Ann Flattery with ABC News. Your line is open, ma'am.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Dr. Redfield, do you believe that schools have been too quick to shut down with cases of COVID in light of this information? And do you think that teachers exposed to the virus should be asked to stay in the classroom because they are essential workers?
Well, I think when I answer your first question, I think it is important to have a plan when a case is identified in the classroom and to really look at that. And CDC has tried to provide guidance how to have that individual basically removed and then isolated from the classroom, do the appropriate contact tracing in conjunction with the local guidance of the local health department and the appropriate disinfection, and not necessarily with a single case then respond more broadly like some institutions have. So I do think it's very important to have a well thought out step-by-step approach to a single case versus whether there's multiple cases in the same classroom, whether there's multiple cases in multiple classrooms, and to work for the schools to then respond to those in a measured way. So I think that's something that we continue to work with schools to help do that with our local health departments. You know, related to teachers, I think the important thing I've always said, yeah, I'm a physician by training, and you know, clearly healthcare professional have a vocation here that we had to stay in the arena to provide medical care to individuals. Obviously, we expected if we were going to do that the system would protect us. They would allow us to do this safely. I would also just underscore how important our teachers are. I mean, their vocation is extremely important. You know that I think they didn't need to be formally recognized as critical infrastructure workers, because in fact, I think we all know they are. I know in my life, my teachers were fundamental. But again, the teachers should be able to expect that if they're going to practice their vocation, that they can do that in a way that's safe, that protects their safety, and of course, sensible. So I think these are going to have to be worked out school by school, local community by local community. I think the most important thing in all of the school openings and reopenings that we have to stay focused on is that in order for schools to reopen and stay open, we have to have the confidence of teachers that it's safe for them to go back and do their job. We have to have confidence of parents that it's safe to have their children in schools, and we have to have confidence in students. You know, I have 11 grandkids, and I think, you know, I have great confidence that my grandchildren go back to school and do this in a safe and sensible way. I've mentioned I do have one grandchild with significant risk, cystic fibrosis, so there's special accommodations that were required for him. But I think, again, it's I just want to congratulate and thank and honor the teachers that recognize the importance of their vocation and work with their school districts to go back and provide this critical, not only academic support for our K-12s, but also, again, it's an important, schools are important parts of emotional support, mental health support, nutritional support, both for students and families.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Brenda Goldman with WebMD. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah. This is Brenda Goodman with WebMD. It looks like, if I'm reading the study, and I breezed through it pretty quickly, that the positivity rate in cases in Rhode Island in June and July were pretty low. And I'm wondering if these results are going to be applicable to areas of the country that have greater transmission right now, because Dr. Redfield, you said schools are connected to their communities. And then a second question, if I may, for the Rhode Island Department of Health officials. Were the schools doing anything to control the potential, or were they cleaning the air at all to control for the potential of aerosol spread? Thank you.
Erin, why don't you take the lead on this and then bring your Amanda in. Thank you.
Sure thing. Thank you. And we do have Amanda De La Grotta on the line from Rhode Island. Amanda?
Hi, good morning, everyone. So I'll speak to the question in terms of how daycare providers and child care providers have controlled the aerosol spread. I'll first say that all of our providers across the state of Rhode Island that are operating child cares had to submit a Rhode Island COVID plan in order to reopen their centers. And so those plans included their infection control measures and increased ventilation practices. We haven't, in our investigations, identified any issues with ventilation, and it doesn't seem to be an issue in our state at this time.
And Aaron, do you want to comment on the first part of the question, the applicability of what we've learned in Rhode Island to maybe other parts of the nation?
Sure. What we've learned from the Rhode Island MMWR is, as Amanda has said, as well as the rest of the authors in the MMWR, is that they were able to open their child care facilities in a safe way by applying different mitigation strategies. And when I say mitigation strategies, I'm talking about distancing, mask use, hand hygiene, cleaning and disinfection. And they also responded quickly whenever there was someone that had signs or symptoms within a child care facility and quarantined for 14 days until the proper follow-up could be done. And so I think this is a great example of really opening in a successful way in a community that had low transmission, and also showed the flexibility and adaptability of the child care facilities to do what was needed to do in order to prevent further transmission.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Next question is from Lena Sun with the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to follow up on the Rhode Island report. Maybe it's because I read it too quickly. You mentioned that even though there was limited secondary transmission, that the impact was substantial and that 853 children and staff members were quarantined. What was the denominator? What was the total number of children and staff who were affected in these programs that you investigated?
Ruth, do you want to go ahead?
We'll turn that question over to Amanda De La Grotta.
Sure. So I'll start from the high-level side. As of right now, we have 666 child cares open in the state. That's at about 75% of total child cares in Rhode Island. And currently, these 666 have a capacity to serve about 18,945 children. In terms of the number of quarantines that we've done, we took a very conservative approach in the beginning. So if a child care reported to us a confirmed case, of course, we would act and quarantine individuals. And given the child care plans that these centers followed and in their processes, they're maintaining stable groups, which are groups of children plus staff of no more than 20. And this stable group structure, which prohibits mixing between these groups, has mitigated the spread of infection.
I understand that part. My question was, it's 853 out of a total population of what? I know the maximum capacity for these places is, 16,000, as you said, but how many, 853, what's the denominator? Is it 16,000? Is it 15,000? Like, what's the approximate number of staff and children in these programs during this time period?
The denominator would be 18,945 children in daycare programs at this time. So that 800 and plus number includes those among the capacity to serve all 18,945.
That was the capacity, but when you opened these, there were only 666. It wasn't at full capacity. Do I just need to do the percentage myself, or do you have like a rough number?
I don't. These 666 programs that have opened are able to serve that capacity of 18,945. So that's how many children are in daycare at this time in our state.
But that was the capacity, and that was what they served, 18,945?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next question, please.
Our next question is from Dorothy Mills Gregg with Inside Health Policy. Your line is open.
Hello. Thank you for doing this call. I'm curious, when we're looking at like transmission rates in the surrounding community, of whether or not you can open up schools and tracking cases, if you could kind of go over some of the way that you're collecting that data and what is the process around there.
Erin, do you want to answer that?
Hi, Dr. Redfield. Hi, this is Erin Sauberschatz. We are working with our state, tribal, local, and territorial health departments to monitor the transmission within the context of the local communities. At CDC, we're providing guidance, resources, and tools to help locals make decisions about opening schools safely, as one example. And so through the monitoring at the local level of various indicators and the level of transmission in the community, that helps to inform whether or not it's safe to open schools for in-person learning. And so I would say that it's a collaborative effort to understand at the local context what the situation is and then make informed decisions for opening schools safely. I feel like I forgot one. Sorry, go ahead.
So then is there like a specific platform that they're submitting the information through?
No, there is not a specific platform.
Next question, please.
No, I gotta go. I'll do it out there.
We'll take the next question when ready, please. Stand by. They have one brief technical issue. Please stand by. Please continue to stand by.
Jill, are you still monitoring this line?
This line is live. Please continue to stand by.
Sir, this is the operator. Can you hear me?
I can't hear you. Are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, sir. We lost connection. We'll go to the next caller. Please stand by.
Understood. Thank you.
Karen Stacy with Financial. You may go ahead.
Hi, yes, Karen Stacy from the Financial Times. I just wanted to know from you, Dr. Redfield, first of all, based on this report from Rhode Island, whether you think schools should now be a little bit less cautious about opening in person, whether they should be more willing to accept children into the actual facilities. And the second question, if I may, not on this topic, but I wondered if you could give me a sense of how important you think it is that all the appropriate and legal milestones are hit before any vaccine is approved.
Dr. Redfield, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was on mute because I didn't want to. So the critical issue here is that really that we build the confidence of teachers and the confidence of parents and confidence of students. So I think the value and really the excellent work done by the Rhode Island Public Health Group is it just provides, I think, data, you know, that when things are done with vigilance in partnership with the public health community, that you can, in fact, in what some people would believe, even a more complex population, individuals in child care, be able to reopen child care and not have significant secondary transmission. So I think it's part of building that confidence. But ultimately, that's the key, is the confidence. And you know, I've always said I want to reopen these schools because it's in the best public health interest of K through 12s, as I've mentioned. But it's got to be done safely and sensibly. It's got to be flexible, and it's got to be done in concert with the teachers and parents and students, the students having confidence in that reopening.
Thank you. And the question about vaccines?
What I'll say about vaccines briefly is that clearly we're moving forward, as you know, with developing a vaccine. I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll have one before the end of the year. That although we've talked about this being at warp speed, it's not at any cuts in our efforts for vaccine safety nor scientific integrity. The real issue and that's accelerated this is the decision to make an investment required to manufacture hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine before you know if that vaccine is going to work. So I'm confident that there'll be all the rigor that we've always had in developing vaccines for human use in terms of the requirements for safety and efficacy, and that the regulatory agencies will pursue that with vigor.
Next question, please.
Our next question is from Sam Whitehead with WABE. Your line is open, sir.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. So, Dr. Rickel, on opening schools, you say individuals should take responsibility to lower the level of COVID-19 in communities and help keep schools open. What about state officials who actually have the ability to make policy? Georgia, for instance, has not been taking many of the recommendations from the White House task force that you sit on. So what do you make of the role and the responsibility of states here to actually put good policies in place to keep parents, teachers, and students safe?
Well, I think we have to say ultimately these behavioral steps, which I've called our critical weapons, they're powerful weapons. The reality is, at the end of the day, it's up to each individual to take that responsibility to embrace the importance of wearing a mask, social distancing, washing your hands, and being smart about crowds. Absolutely no question that example and leadership can help reinforce that. Some states, as you know, have decided that the best way to reinforce it is to actually go ahead and require it. Other states have felt that the best way to get more people to do what needs to be done is to set the example. You know, so I continue to appeal to the individual American public to embrace these steps as the powerful weapons that they are, do their part to help us all protect the vulnerable, which is really the goal line here, is to minimize the mortality and morbidity that this virus causes. But and to do that, what we need to do is one individual at a time work collectively to reduce the transmission in our individual communities. No doubt they can be reinforced by leadership to move in that direction, but ultimately at the end of the day, and this is unfortunate for us, that this virus doesn't require a lot of times you can have a behavior that if half of us do, we can make progress. This virus isn't going to require half of us to do the mitigation steps correctly. It's not even going to require 75% of us to get this right. We really do need to see, you know, 90%, 95%, 96% and more percent embrace the wearing of the mask, the social distancing, the hand hygiene, and the and wisdom about how one engages in crowded places. And if we all do this, and I think we saw that example in Arizona, where, you know, starting to see the example in other jurisdictions. So I will come back, and I've said it before when President Kennedy said, you know, don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And to paraphrase that now, what we're asking the American public is our ability to bring this outbreak to its knees. It's in our hands. It's in our grasp. But it is going to require all of us to embrace these mitigation steps. And we're going to need to do that for 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks. And then we will see this outbreak get under control. I'm still going to vote with the American public that we're going to move in that direction. I think we're seeing progress over the last 4 weeks. I hope that progress will continue. But I think we should, none of us should turn away from the recognition that that it's key that each of us recognize that we want to make sure that COVID stops with us.
Does that not give state officials who actually have the ability to make policy a pass here?
Hey, I'm sorry to cut you off. We need to, if you just follow up with us, media@cdc.gov, we'll be happy to follow up with you on that. Can we get to our next question, please?
Our next question is from Mary Ellen McIntyre with CQ Roll Call. Your line is open.
Hi there. Thanks for doing this. Dr. Redfield, I wanted to follow up on some comments you made yesterday about CDC conducting a national survey on antibody testing. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you think the state of serological testing is in the U.S. right now, and is the CDC undertaking any initiatives to improve or consolidate that to kind of make up for the current sort of patchwork approach on consistency and transparency?
Well, I think there's a variety of antibody tests that are out that that actually are high quality. And I know the FDA has continued to review those tests and make recommendations accordingly. What CDC continues to do is to try to use this as a tool, as a sort of a surveillance tool to, for us to better understand the extent of infection that occurred in our nation. You know, our recent report in JAMA that gave a glimpse of the interrelationship, at least between March, April, and May, of the diagnosed infections compared to the evidence of infection that we could gather by larger antibody surveillance, and really came with the data to suggest that for every diagnosed case by our system in our nation, there was probably 10 more cases that actually occurred. So rather than 2 million infections in the nation, there was more like 20 million. What it is now for June, July, and August, we don't know. We're currently obviously continuing those evaluations. It's very geographically variable. You have some jurisdictions where it's clearly less than 1% have seen evidence of an infection, and you have other jurisdictions like New York where it may be over 20%. So we'll continue. You know, I think it's important for us to understand the extent of infection, who was really susceptible to this infection. It helps us understand, obviously, the overall impact in terms of mortality, morbidity, in terms of a broader population. But I do think we have a variety of highly quality antibody tests, which I would refer you to the FDA. And they continue to evaluate to see if there's any of those tests that should not be endorsed.
We have time for two more questions. Next question, please.
It comes from Amy Birnbaum with CBS News. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking my question. I wanted to ask how important it was to have the low incidence in order to be able to mount a rapid and robust response. And you talked about other communities being able to look at this data. So how would you suggest the public evaluate the resources of their public health departments in order to be able to model the kind of response that was demonstrated in this report by Rhode Island? I mean, is there a suggested number of contact tracers or, you know, number of man hours that should be devoted per case and type of testing? So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what the public can do to find that out.
Erin, do you or Amanda want to address that?
Yeah, sure. Hi, this is Erin Slavershots. We have seen as in the United States as well as in other countries that schools are able to open safely in communities with low transmission. It's more of a challenge in communities that have more widespread transmission. And as Dr. Redfield said, we really do need everyone to help us fight COVID-19 and do the mitigation strategies that are our best line of defense right now. And so by doing those things, we'll help lower the transmission in communities and be closer to being able to open schools safely. And, of course, if there are areas that have high transmission, that will put additional burden on health departments and require more additional support from the health departments. Dr. Redfield, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think the important point, and obviously the questioner is astute, you know, obviously there's a tipping point when the extent of the infection does, in fact, negate the effectiveness of the traditional early case identification, contact tracing, isolation. I think that said, there's also that tipping point as we begin to get these red zone areas to turn to yellow, to turn to green, when these important public health steps really have enormous value. And I just, again, want to extend my appreciation, congratulations to the Rhode Island public health team. You know, I think, you know, a lot of people, when they chose to, you know, open up, you know, hundreds and hundreds of child care programs and to really be proactive in doing it in a way that not only monitored and evaluated, but really worked hard to try to make sure they mitigated any risk of secondary transmission. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to highlight it does, it does show the possible. And I think, you know, a majority of our nation at this point, actually, if you look at it by county, is in areas that we would call green zones, that is, that less than 5% of tests are positive. So I think this is an inspiring article to tell individuals that there is a path where one can use and partner with their public health authorities and safely get these child care programs reopened, which, again, are very important for our country to be able to get child care. And, again, as an extension is we're trying to get these schools reopened, and I think people have heard my position that I really do believe strongly that it's in the public health interest of K-12s to get back to face-to-face learning, and we just have to work collectively to do that in a safe and sensible way, one school, one jurisdiction, one family at a time.
Okay, and if we could take our last question, please.
That will come from Mike Stobie with the Associated Press. Your line is open, sir.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Rickel, I confess I'm a little confused by your answers regarding to who gets credit in Rhode Island, the state and the state policies or the individuals. But actually, since I have limited questions, let me ask you to clarify something else. Ann Flannery's question about teachers and critical infrastructure workers. I'm sorry, could you clarify? Do you think it's okay for an infected teacher to be back in the classroom if they're not symptomatic?
Well, the critical infrastructure guidance that we have, and this all outlines around benefit, as you know, these were individuals that were at high risk and for exposure, but had not been diagnosed and were asymptomatic. for example, the doctors and nurses shortage that we had, the meatpacking plant. Again, if someone had known infection, we're obviously, our recommendations are those individuals need to be isolated based on our guidance. This is the issue if someone had a known exposure and is not necessarily known to be infected, and they were a member of critical infrastructure, and individuals will evaluate that. Clearly, when there weren't enough doctors to staff the hospital in the state of Washington, or there weren't enough firemen and policemen because of people being isolated that had been exposed, not necessarily infected, we came up with the critical infrastructure guidance allowing those individuals that were asymptomatic to return to a critical duty, provided they wore a face covering and monitored their symptoms. If they became symptomatic, they needed to be removed. So a direct answer was I would not have an infected individual, someone with known infection. I would have them follow our guidance until that infection had completed its resolution.
Thank you for that. And also, can you give us a couple of highlights of the new school guidance that you said are being announced today? What's the big changes?
It's not really changes as much as additional information and considerations for schools. It's just continuing to build on the data and the information that we had been publishing actually all the way back since, as you know, February and March. So we've just added more information that helps administrators. You know, some considerations on how to promote behaviors that would reduce spread, how to make sure they keep the environment healthy, how they some guidance about healthy operations and considerations within the school to limit COVID risk. And obviously there's some more about what to do and how to prepare to react when a student, in fact, in a classroom does get sick. So these are more as additional consideration documents to continue the dialogue that really come as a consequence of the dialogues that we've been having with school districts. I do want to reiterate one thing here, that CDC stands ready to assist any school district across the country or school to, as they're trying to figure out how to implement the guidance documents that we have to provide technical assistance as they try to take that and make it practically work for their school. We'll continue to do that, and these documents are just more of that, to continue that dialogue of sharing information on those key areas of the basically healthy behaviors, healthy environments, healthy operation, and what to do when someone gets sick.
Thank you, Dr. Redfield, and thank you all for joining us today. The embargo lists at 1 p.m., so in Eastern, so in just a couple of minutes. If you have any additional questions, please call our media line, 404-639-3286. Or you can email media at cdc.gov. And thank you again for joining us today.
That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect and have a great rest of your day.